My name is Carl. My name is Carl Felicio with the United States Department of Labor, and thanks for joining us today. Secretary Solis met with the families earlier today, and so before she takes off for D.C., she wanted to make a few brief remarks before we start the press conference. Thanks.
Thank you, Carl, and I want to thank everyone for being here this afternoon. Before I start my remarks, I want to just explain, quite frankly, that one of the reasons why I'm here is because I met earlier with the families. I wanted to hold to my commitment to come back and meet with the families to be able to issue the report that we promised them more than a year ago. And I want to mention that because I think it's very important. This is now the fourth time that I've been here visiting with the families and working with our staff, and I want to commend our staff for all the work that they have done to put forward. But I want to draw your attention back to that day, April the 5th, 2010. As you know, that was the worst American coal mining disaster in our history in 40 years. It took place in here in West Virginia. And on April 6th was when I came back here and sat vigil with family members and loved ones of the miners who were trapped underground. We all prayed for a miracle that never came. That explosion at the Upper Big Branch claimed 29 lives and forever changed so many. As we all came to terms with the scope of the tragedy before us, I made a promise to the family members and to the community. And I promised that my department would conduct a far-reaching investigation into the root causes of the explosion that would be sweeping in scope. I promised that we would pursue every lead and spare no expense to learn what happened at UBB and honor the lives that were lost. I promised that we would follow the evidence wherever it took us until we arrived at the truth. And I promised that I would return to West Virginia to personally deliver our findings. I just spent time with the families here. Again, they're the reason why I'm here today. And I continue to be inspired by their resilience and by their courage and by their faith. And I want to thank them for their patience as we've worked to complete our report. It's here before you. Before we start the press conference itself, I want to know that you know about the agreement announced today between the U.S. Department of Justice and Alpha Natural Resources. We're encouraged that Alpha is making investments in mine safety and research, and that they've agreed to promptly pay Massey legacy fines and the record penalties levied by MSHA this morning. However, that does not change the task before us, nor does it diminish the serious nature of the violations that our investigation uncovered. Earlier today, MSHA issued 12 citations and orders for violations of the Mine Act that directly contributed to the explosion at the South Mine at the Upper Big Branch. MSHA determined 9 of these violations to be flagrant. These are the most serious type of violations that MSHA can issue and has. Flagrant violations are eligible for the highest penalties possible under the Mine Act. MSHA also issued 357 separate violations of the Mine Act for conditions and practices at UBB that did not directly contribute to the explosion. For these infractions, MSHA levied fines of more than $10.8 million, the largest penalty in the history of our agency. The conditions that led to the explosion were the result of widespread safety violations at the Upper Big Branch. Our investigation uncovered systemic and intentional efforts by PCC and Massey to avoid compliance with safety and health standards. The root cause of this tragedy was a series of unlawful policies and practices implemented by PCC and Massey. Company officials disregarded serious safety hazards and enforced a workplace culture that valued profits over people. Had top officials adhered to basic safety practices, the explosion would have been contained or prevented. and we believe these lives would have been saved. Our investigation found that PCC Massey used its security staff to alert mine personnel when safety inspectors arrived at the mine. This allowed violations to be concealed, so no corrective action could be ordered. Our investigation also uncovered evidence that miners were intimidated by management into remaining silent about safety violations at the risk of losing their jobs or being terminated. The Mine Act requires operators to keep a set of detailed books that denotes health and safety hazards. PCC Massey kept two sets of books. One, a doctored set that omitted hazards and violations, which was shown to inspectors and employees. And a second set of books that recorded hazards, which were only shown to management. Before I leave you, I want to commend my staff at MSHA, our personnel here today with me, my Assistant Secretary, Joe Main, also my solicitor, Tricia Smith, and also Kevin Strickland, and the hundreds and hundreds of investigators and staff that helped put forward this report that's being issued today. I want to thank all of them. I want to thank them for their tireless effort on behalf of the victims and their families for helping us seek the truth. Our work is not done. We continue to work with the Department of Justice to continue our cooperation with the families, and I would leave you with that. Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to officially start the press briefing. Assistant Secretary Joe Main will take it from here. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Now, since we began our investigation of the tragedy at the Upper Big Branch Mine, which occurred on April 5th, 2010, we have provided the families with a number of briefings. Matter of fact, we just finished our 11th briefing just a little while ago, bringing the families information on the report that we're officially releasing today. And we made a commitment to the families when we started this that families would be first in terms of the release of any information, and that is part of the process that we continue today. We followed many of those family briefings with briefings to Congress and briefings to the public, and this again follows the same process that we have used since we began the investigation of the tragedy at the Upper Big Branch Mine, which claimed the lives of 29 miners. We've tried to balance the unprecedented briefings with our investigation to both protect the investigative process and to keep the families and Congress and the public as informed as we could. And I think this is a process that has worked well for all. And I've appreciated all the patience over the last number of months as we have developed our findings and have put us in a position to release our report today. This is probably the most extensive investigation that has been undertaken, and rightfully so, and at least in modern time in the mining industry with regard to a mining accident. And we have worked hard as an agency to get to the bottom of what went wrong on April the 5th. And we are also working earnestly to see that those responsible are held accountable. That's work still to be done. There is more work to be done, and this release of the report today is only the next phase of where our investigative process has taken us. We have agreed from the outset to work cooperatively with the Department of Justice and the conducting of the investigation, and to see that those who are accountable are held to justice. I can tell you today, we fully intend to keep that pledge as we move forward. In addition to the ongoing investigation by Department of Justice, we have our internal review that is underway. And this is a review process of our policies and procedures prior to the accident that is undertaken after every one of these events. And I believe it started back in 1989 after the Pyro Mine disaster, and has been a part of the agency process ever since. We will be releasing that report in the future as we are able to complete that as well. As we all know, the state of West Virginia is still continuing their investigation and is expected to issue a report sometime here in the near future. We have already made a number of changes in mine safety from the lessons that we've learned from this tragic event, and we're going to continue to make those changes and more changes to improve mine safety as we move forward. As part of our overall responsibilities as an agency, we will have recommendations from both our investigation team and our internal review team at the closure of the internal review report on actions to be taken regarding policies of the agency, regulatory actions. As noted, we've already undertaken a number of changes, and we expect to announce more over the next number of months. I'm going to turn over the presentation to Kevin Strickland, who I think most folks know, that's been with our investigative process since the outset. And Kevin is going to walk through the summary of our investigative findings. And once we conclude that, we will take questions from the folks that are here today. So I ask that you all be patient, allow Kevin to walk through his presentation, and we'll get to the question and answer session after that. As Kevin's coming up, I just want to let everybody know that the report, the interview transcripts, the company mine examination records, a number of other documents have been posted along with our report and the appendices to our report on our website today. So those are available to the general public as we speak. Kevin?
Thank you, Joe. We appreciate everybody's interest in being here today. This culminates one phase of what we've done. The accident happened on April the 5th of 2010, as you all know, nearly 20 months ago. And when something like this happens, if you're passionate about mine health and safety, it brings you to your knees. No other way to explain it. Basically, our job as MSHA regulators, we can't do anything more than find the cause of the explosion, share it with the public so none of us ever have to go through this again and go through what the families are going through. I thank the families for their patience for the 20 months that it took us to come up with this report that's in front of you here today. It's 13 pounds, over 1,000 pages. It's the most extensive report that I've ever seen, that I've ever been associated with. I want to just thank the whole team of MSHA people that gave me 20 months of their lives to put this report together. And I want to thank all of you in the reporting corps for your patience, and I think you've been fair with us, and as we try to work through this, I'm going to try not to bore you today. What we're going to try to do is go through new and additional information that we have not shared with you. As we said in June, probably 95% of our investigation had been completed. The 5% missing was the root cause, the contributory violations, the actual writing of the report. And it's been a team effort from all of us at MSHA, including the solicitors who worked side by side with us to come up with this report. I want to mention to all of you, besides the fact that you have a copy of the report, there are a number of other things that are going to be available to you on our website. I'm sure they're already there. Number one is there's all the transcripts, other than about a handful, have been released and is available for you to look at on our website. There is a few held. Basically, the Department of Justice has talked to us, asked, as their investigation continues, there's some that they feel there's some information in there that they want to keep close to the vest for their own investigation. Those have been held. There's a CD or the PowerPoint is provided. We also included a video on animation, which is a little different than what we've done in the past. It's for informational purposes. It basically shows the crew of men going into the mine at the beginning of their shift and actually animates the long wall being cut for the entire shift when it was stopped because of need for maintenance and when it started up again, that type of thing. It's a, if you're not familiar with mining, I think the video could be a little helpful to all of you in understanding a little bit about the concept that was in place on April the 5th. And also there's a number of books, the examination books that we've released. It's on our website as well, the weekly, the pre-shift exam, and electrical record books. You have to bear with us a little bit. We have 80,000 pages in addition to that. It's been a real race to the end here to get everything completed for this December 6th presentation and the report release that we've given today. We have issued the violations to the company today. We also issued violations to contractors. We've met with the United Mine Workers, one of the representatives, Moreland & Moreland, the other representative, as well as the state agencies. So basically, we're in the process of just sharing the information, issuing the violations, and it's kind of the way we make sure we do business to keep everybody informed. But naturally, no one came before the families. We met with the families here. We had about a two-hour meeting with them, tried to answer every question they may have, and we'll keep that door open with the families. That's something that we're going to continue to try to satisfy any needs or things that they want from us in this time of need. I call this closure for the investigation team because the report's out. We don't know what the families go through. I don't walk in their shoes. I don't know if they'll ever have closure. And this is just a part of something that they need to see in writing as to what occurred, in our opinion. We tried to be as honest as we could, and we shared that with the families. With that, we have two sets of slides here, one showing some maps, mine showing the presentation of the PowerPoint, listing the 29 miners. The other two people that we can't forget about is the two survivors of this explosion, Mr. Blake and Mr. Woods. When we started our investigation and we started meeting with the families on certain times, we said we were going to go by the golden rule. And the golden rule was whatever we told you, it wasn't going to change. And we stood by that. We haven't taken back one statement we've ever made. And basically, we stand by the first statement we made on April the 5th that 29 miners' deaths were preventable. We still feel that way. Massey Management engaged in practices and procedures that resulted in noncompliance with the Mine Act and regulations. The operator did not take proper measurements to detect methane. There were many cases when methane detector was turned off by examiners as they were in the mine. That's unacceptable anywhere, but it's very unacceptable at a mine that liberates methane gases on a spot inspection series. I mean, it's just, you need to know the methane concentrations in your mine. The individual who turned it off worked in by the longwall face just prior to, he came out of this area 30 minutes prior to the explosion. That information is critical information that we would have liked to have seen as an investigator to see exactly what the concentrations of gas were. And without a detector being turned on, there's no way for us to ascertain that. It's an example of technology, though. We were able to download that information from methane detectors to find out what the concentrations were and when the detectors were actually on or off. The operator also did not comply with the approved ventilation plan and the approved roof control plan. The operator did not rock dust the mine adequately. Accumulations of loose coal, coal dust, and float coal dust were not cleaned up and removed from the mine. The report finding, again, this hasn't changed. The explosion most likely started with the initial methane natural gas ignition by the cutting bits on the tail drum of the longwall shear, which likely generated hot streaks on the sandstone roof or floor. Now, the coal seam at UBB was approximately 54 inches in height, but the operator mined sandstone both above and below the coal seam. As these worn bits were striking the coal, it caused sparks and hot smears to be present, and an ignition was created from those hot smears. Flame from that initial ignition then ignited an accumulation of methane, resulting in a methane explosion. the methane explosion, it was small in size. When I speak of small, if you can think of a methane explosion as being small, it was approximately 20 foot wide, the width of an entry, about 10 to 12 feet long by the 8 foot height of the coal seam. That's the size of the methane explosion, or the body of methane that we feel blew up. After that, it propagated coal dust into the atmosphere and caused this massive coal dust explosion that occurred. We have ruled out cutting into a gas well, a massive methane inundation, and a seismic event. To be fair and honest with the evaluation, the two things we could not rule out, but we think they're minuscule impossibilities, would be a roof fall and the pan line, which is a metal-on-metal connection on the longwall face that could have caused a spark. We're very confident in saying that we think it was the shearing machine that ignited the methane. The root cause: Massey management engaged in practices and procedures that resulted in noncompliance with the Mine Act and regulations. I talked earlier about the intimidation of miners. From testimony, we learned that Massey personnel, advance notice, Massey personnel were routinely notified before inspectors arrived on the section. Dispatchers were ordered by upper management to give advance notice, or if it didn't, there would be consequences. One dispatcher told us that it was just simply a part of doing business to call underground and let the section know that MSHA was coming. Advance notice gave the operator more time to correct conditions that weren't in compliance with the regulation. Having said that, our inspectors issued more orders at this mine than any other mine in the country, even with advance notice going on. There were 48 D orders, which are unwarrantable failures by the mine operator, that we issued here. An order basically stops production until the condition is corrected. On October 26th, the head of security was convicted of a felony for making false statements to MSHA. He told MSHA that UBB had a policy prohibiting security guards from providing advance notice. However, evidence indicated that he himself had directed guards to provide such advance notice. And failure to maintain the required information in record books. At the last briefing, we gave you examples of two sets of books that were kept here. And I was on record as saying at that time it's okay to keep two sets of books, but you have to record all your hazards in the official record book. What we found here wasn't that way. As you look on the right, this example, this particular example dealt with having all the sprays in operation on the shearing machine. In the production and maintenance record book, it says, added 5 gallons of oil to the tail ranging arm, had no water on either drum, cleaned several and stopped right back up, removed 8 on each end, ran like that for the rest of the shift to try and flush the drums, told the third crew. When you look at the official record book on the left, you can see there's no mention of anything like that. That's very important information for anybody to have. Number one, it's unacceptable to operate the shearing machine without water. But for an MSHA inspector that would come on site, it would be very important for him to know what was going on in the mine, especially if he was going to inspect that. It's also an example of something that can be changed pretty quickly. Putting sprays in a shearing machine probably takes less than a minute per spray. So those can be quickly added to put into the shearing machine before an MSHA inspector would be arriving on the section. Massey's action reflected a pervasive culture that valued production over safety, creating a significant hazard to the safety and health of the UBB miners. The corrective action is any commitment to health and safety must extend to all management and corporate officers and be monitored and enforced at the highest level. Those that instill and condone a dangerous culture must be held accountable for their actions. We get into contributory contributing factors. I guess when we put the presentation together, we started with what would be the first thing that you would do. And the first thing you need to do is be trained. Massey did not comply with the approved training plan. There were a number of instances where there was no or inadequate training in hazard recognition, in the roof and ventilation plans and new worker tasks. The team did an extensive review of all the people that worked at UBB and found that there were 112 miners that received no or inadequate experience miner training. There were 21 miners that received no annual refresher training. There were a number of miners when we interviewed them that didn't know the requirements of the ventilation or roof control plans because they were never trained in it. Examination is a contributing factor. It was not ensured that adequate pre-shift, on-shift, and weekly exams were being performed. Many of the exams did not identify hazards. Air courses were not examined, did not energize detectors for extended periods of time. I gave the example of the examiner who went in by the long wall section. His detector had not been turned on since March the 18th, which is over a two-week period prior to the explosion. No regular examinations in the tailgate entry near the long wall face, and on-shift respirable dust checks and methane tests were not being performed as required. We had numerous examples as we went through the books and dug as deeply as we did of examples of not fulfilling the requirements of the examination rules. Correction of hazards. Massey did not ensure that hazardous conditions were immediately corrected or posted. When recorded, numerous hazards remain uncorrected. As example, the belt examination rule, if you recall in June, we showed a chart of all the different times that in the belt examination books it indicated that additional work or corrective action was needed to correct the hazards associated with not enough rock dust, and there were very few of those times that corrective action was actually taken and rock dust applied in those areas. Several people testified that mine management pressured them not to record hazards in the required examination book. Failure to maintain the long wall shear in a safe operating condition. There were two worn bits on the face ring of the tail drum. They were missing the carbide tips. Now, someone could say, well, that's only two. Well, to have an ignition, you only need one that's worn. That's all you need, just one spark, especially when you don't have water sprays operating the way they should be. Studies have shown that worn bits pose a significant ignition hazard. Frictional heat from those worn bits striking the rock is the most likely source of the ignition, according to the investigation team. Each drum has 48 bits and 45 sprays on it. It did not comply with the approved ventilation plan. Evidence showed that the shear operated with missing or clogged water sprays. I showed you that earlier where the operator had taken sprays out to keep water flowing through the drum. At the time of the explosion, there were seven sprays that were missing from the tail drum. If you recall the video that we showed on it, it looked as if there were seven water hoses spraying out and no other water coming out of any of the other sprays. We configured the system the best we could, along with Massey, the state, and the representatives in December of 2010, to bring water from the outside into the mine and try to hook up the water system similar to what it would have been right before the explosion occurred. And when we did that and put enough pressure on it to operate it the way it should be operated, that was the result of the video that we showed with the sprays totally missing, water coming out of those, and no water coming out of the other sprays that were in place. There was an inadequate filtering system that was in place was the cause of this. Water was pumped from the river. It wasn't filtered enough to keep that dirt and grit from getting into the water system and actually allowing itself to plug into the sprays. Testimony indicated that operating with missing sprays was a practice here. There wasn't enough air maintained at the face to dilute the methane below not only explosive limits but below 1%. The law requires you to stay below 1% anytime you're mining coal. We know that we had 5% there based on what occurred. Massey did not comply with the approved roof control plan. The roof control plan in the tailgate required two sets of supports, a double row. It could be cable bolts or it could be posts. This is very significant. It seems pretty small, but basically what this does is it allows air that comes across the longwall face, instead of coming back onto the operators that's working on the face, it allows it to be pulled away towards the Bandytown fan. The tighter the restriction without having this support in place causes the airflow from behind the shields and in the cracks to come back onto the face. There was nowhere for the air to go to get away from it, and we think that it came back onto the face where the men were working at the shearing machine. The mine was not rock dusted adequately. The picture that's shown here on the second PowerPoint, the red line shows the extent of the flames throughout the mine after the explosion. We call this the affected area. 90% of the rock dust samples that we took in this affected area did not meet the requirements of the law. Massey failed to ensure that accumulations of loose coal, coal dust, and float coal dust were cleaned up and removed from the mine. Several witnesses said the tailgate of the longwall needed rock dusting. We found no evidence during our investigation to indicate that 1 ounce of rock dust was put into the tailgate after longwall mining began in September of 2009. There was only a single rock dust crew at the mine. It was composed of a motor operator and a helper that was responsible for bulk dusting the track and the belts of the entire mine. The dust equipment frequently failed. The piece of unit that they used was 20 years old. It had a hard time staying in operation. A notebook kept by the crew had an entry in it 2 weeks prior to the explosion, and we showed you that note at a previous meeting. No ride, no help, no spotter. I am set up to fail here. You all know the mine has been a subject of an ongoing investigation, and the mine is still under a 103K order as we speak. For us to lift that K order, if Alpha decides that's the route they want to go, we're looking for a comprehensive corrective action plan, both to go in and rehabilitate the mine, as well as if they decide that after they rehabilitate it, they want to mine coal, we're looking for a comprehensive plan from them on how they're going to make sure none of this occurs again. Again, the commitment to health and safety must extend to all mine management members and corporate officials, and be monitored and enforced at the highest levels. Those that instill and condone a dangerous culture must be held accountable for their actions or inactions. Now, getting into the contributory violations, we issued 14 contributory violations, 12 of them to Massey. A contributory violation is a violation that contributed to the cause or severity of the accident, that had some role in what occurred here. A non-contributory violation is any other accident, or any other violation, I'm sorry. Lynn, could you go back to the slide on the flame map? We call this the affected area. We issued a number of violations prior to today. That was in out-by area. Go to the next one for me, Lynn. That would be in all these out-by areas on the surface. As the investigation team found things, they had to cite it. By non-contributory that we issued today, we issued 360. It would be violations in this circle that I'm showing you with the power, the laser pointer. In by cross-cut, 68. So that's the differential between what we've done in the past and what we've done today. We boxed them all up today and issued them, as I said, to Alpha earlier in the day. The first contributory violation is 103A of the Mine Act for giving advance notice. Investigation determined that this was a regular practice, communicated underground, allowing an hour or more from the gate to the section, correction of hazards and cleanup prior to the inspector arriving on the section. Now, I think I mentioned this earlier. As much of a head start as this gave the operator, we still issued more orders at this mine than any other mine in the country in the year leading up to the explosion. So there were still a lot of things that, while they corrected some, there were still stuff that was not corrected that we did cite. These were both This is considered a flagrant violation and reckless disregard by the company. A flagrant violation is a reckless failure to make reasonable efforts to eliminate a known violation of a mandatory health or safety standard that reasonably could have been expected to cause death or serious bodily injury. Reckless disregard means conduct which exhibits the absence of the slightest degree of care. So this violation is considered a flagrant, and it's a reckless disregard. The next violation, a contributory violation, is on training. We had, as I said, a number of training issues that we found during our extensive review. Experienced minor training, task training, annual refresher training, and many other deficiencies. And again, we found this violation to be a flagrant violation and reckless disregard. Getting into the examinations, we issued four different exam violations, the first one being under pre-shift, where there were failure to conduct pre-shift examinations, failure to measure air quantities, failure to record hazards and correct hazards, and failure to verify record by mine management. What we also did here is we issued a contributory violation to David Stanley Consultants. They're a contractor who did pre-shift examinations at this mine. There was only one individual from David Stanley Consultants that worked here, but basically it showed the same level of inadequacy as the violation that we issued to Massey for pre-shift examinations. On-shift examination, it requires ongoing hazards that are supposed to be noted. In this case, ongoing hazards were not noted. Failure to correct accumulation hazards, failure to conduct methane checks, failure to conduct equipment checks. This also was a flagrant, reckless disregard. The third examination violation is a weekly examination. Failure to conduct weekly examinations, failure to examine, go to approved evaluation points and measuring points, failure to travel all required areas, and failure to correct hazardous conditions. This also was a flagrant, reckless disregard violation. And lastly, concerning examination is 363A, the correcting or posting of dangerous conditions. Conditions weren't corrected. They weren't posted with danger signs. There were repeated notations, as I mentioned earlier to you, of accumulations along the belt with nothing being done. Failure to take air readings and failure to take gas readings. This violation or contributory violation was also issued to David Stanley Consultants as well. A violation of 1725 for failure to maintain the longwall shear in proper operating conditions, where we had the missing or worn bits. In this case, we had two worn bits that caused the spark. And here's a picture of the bits. You know, some people say, I remember when we did this originally, a slide not long after ours showing good slide or good bits on the tail drum. All you need is one bad bit to cause an ignition. And we had that here, especially when you don't have your water sprays in place. And that leads me to my next contributory violation, violation of the ventilation plan. Failure to maintain adequate number of water sprays on the shear is required by the plan. It required 43 sprays to be in place. There were 7 sprays removed to keep water flowing so that the sprays didn't clog up. No matter how much water we put on the shear in December of 2010, no matter how much water pressure we put on, we could not get basically much water at all coming out of those sprays, and we couldn't measure any water pressure on the shearing machine. Failure to dilute and render harmless, 75321. Failure to maintain the volume and velocity of the air current in areas where persons work or travel to keep it diluted and carried away from the active areas. Again, that's a contributory violation. A violation of the roof control plan, 75220, where we already talked that it required two sets of posts or two cable bolts in line as mining was being conducted. As it was coming out, the operator had to have this in place, and that's to ensure an airflow path back towards the Bandytown fan. So the bad air didn't come back out onto the longwall face where the people were working at. Here's a picture of just in by the face in the tailgate entry. Pretty easy to see that there's just one row of posts instead of two. Very difficult to see, but in this area here you have a fall. You expect a fall, but what you want to do is try to keep it open enough to have airflow going away from the face. In this case, we think that the air course was restricted because of only one row of posts, and the gas that was being liberated from the floor actually came out onto the face rather than being carried away from the longwall mining people working in the area there. Coal accumulation is another contributory violation under 75-400. Coal accumulations, including float coal dust, loose coal, and other combustibles, were not cleaned up and removed. The pictures I'm showing you here are from our report, and I know you all have a copy of them. You'll find that in there. There's a picture of a mound of accumulations that were in place during our investigation. The next one here shows a conveyor belt. You can see the frame, the metal frame of it, the bottom belt, underneath the bottom belt, the roller, and you see the roller that would be spinning in this coal accumulation located under the belt. Again, these everything is in more depth in our report, but those are just a few of the pictures that we pulled out of it. And a contributory violation that's flagrant and reckless disregard under 75-403, where we collected 1,353 samples in the affected area, and 91% of them didn't meet the requirements of the law. Failure to sufficiently inert the coal dust, float coal dust, and other accumulations. In all, we issued 12 contributory violations to Massey, 9 of them being flagrant. We issued 2 contributory violations to David Stanley Consultants, who was a contractor and conducted examinations here. We issued 360 non-contributory violations today, 78 of which were D2 orders or unwarrantable failure by the mine operator. 12 of those 360 would be considered flagrant. The penalties associated with that, about $10.8 million in penalties was issued today to Massey, to Alpha, and $142,000 in penalties was issued to David Stanley Consultants. This is the largest penalty that MSHA's ever issued. The second largest was $2.3 million, so it's about 5 times the maximum that we have ever issued in the past. All of the flagrants were issued a maximum amount allowed by law, $220,000, and all the other D orders that weren't flagrant but were contributory were issued or ordered or came with $70,000 per violation, which is also the maximum. And we issued a couple of non-contributories to David Stanley as well as Mountaineer Lab Solutions. The total amount during this is $10,968. I feel uncomfortable standing up in front of the families talking about how much money, because money don't bring anybody back. There's 29 fatalities. Money doesn't mean anything to them as we talk to them today. There's other things on their mind, but it's part of the system that's in place. And you can't say that $220,000 for a fine is enough for what's occurred here for each of these violations, but it's what we're mandated to do and required to do by law. So that's the total amount that has come in play here. In concluding, the operator failed to follow the Mine Act and its regulations but to provide for a safe and healthy work environment for its miners. As a result, 29 miners were killed in a coal dust explosion that started as a methane ignition due to practices and procedures that encourage noncompliance, lack of proper examinations, lack of equipment maintenance, failure to follow approved ventilation and roof control plans, failure to clean up accumulations and rock dust adequately. All of these conclusions contributed to the propagation of an explosion that was preventable. With that, that's just a short synopsis of the report, and I think at this time, we will sit up here and take any questions that any of you may have. If you just wait a second, let me get my other two folks up here and we'll take your questions, sir.
I think Amy's got more questions.
I'm going to go ahead and sit here. I'll go around the other side. I'm going to go behind him.
If you would like to ask a question via the phone lines, please press star 1 and record your name clearly.
At this time, we're going to open up for questions from the folks here in Beckley, and when we've exhausted all the questions here, then we'll turn to the people on the phone lines. And since we do have reporters who have called in, it would be helpful if those of you asking questions could use one of the three microphones, either the one in the middle or one of the two on either side. Just if you can't get to the center mic, might just raise your hand and one of the folks with the roving mic will come and assist you. And the three persons here at the table who are going to be answering the questions are Patricia Smith, Solicitor of Labor, Joseph Main, Assistant Secretary of Labor, and Kevin Strickland, the Administrator for Coal Mine Safety and Health. With that, we'll start with the questions.
Books from Coal Outlook. Everything, you didn't say this directly, Mr. Strickland, but it implies this was an operation that was an accident waiting to happen. Why wasn't it shut from production sometime during the year before the explosion? And my second, let me get quickly, how much of Alpha is Alpha liable for this $10.8 million? And who is that $2.3 million fine issued to, the second largest one? Thank you.
We did shut the mine down 48 times in the year leading up to the explosion. I mentioned we had 48 unavoidable failures issues. What we don't have is the ability to say, because you received so many orders, we're going to shut you down permanently. What we have to do is, after the mine operator corrects the condition that we cite, we have to allow them to go back to mine full. So we did shut them down. Looking back, I mean, when we say an accident waiting to happen, we thought we were keeping accidents from occurring. No one did that in this case. But I think my folks who were out inspecting did their job by issuing 48 orders at this
time. Did have the power to permanently shut it at the time?
We don't have the power to permanently shut it now either, sir.
And
what's
the question of how much is Alpha liable for? They're liable for all of the penalties that were assessed to the legacy management companies, not penalties that were assessed to the contractor.
Hi, I'm Kenny Woods from the Charleston Gazette. Joe, the report talks in terms about the methane report, and I'm wondering if you discussed that in the report mentions that Matthew apparently never followed up on recommendations from ETSHA on how to deal with the previous problems in that regard at this mine. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what your internal review has found so far about why ETSHA never followed up on that problem. And do you think that issue points the finger at previous country administrations for not fixing that?
Well, Ken, just spend a minute on the internal review. The internal review hasn't concluded just yet. We ETSHA has traditionally had this report released somewhat 2 to 3 months after the investigation report, and we plan to do OP along that same timeline. And that is one of the issues that we have asked the internal review to look at. One of the things I think we can't miss here is that whatever the outcome of that is and how we dealt with that, the mine operator had the information that was available to make determinations about controlling the conditions in that mine in 2003-2004 period. We're looking at that issue as well.
Question.
Dennis has asked, and I'm working with America. First of all, I'd like to thank you guys for the cooperation and the investigation. So we had to, thus bringing up my point. This is the third reputable report that has come out. Your report, McAteer's report to the government, Governor's independent report, and the UMWA's. This confirms the UMWA's report as to the cause of the disaster and reinforces that those responsible need to be held accountable. That includes those at the highest level of the company who are aware of the dangerous conditions and did nothing. The UMWA would like to urge the Justice Department and U.S. Attorney to follow the trail of the corporate ladder to the highest level. I know Alpha has said that they will do certain things as part of this global settlement, but at any time during the discussions that Alpha had with you, did they say or give any indication they will join you and the rest of the mining community in supporting legislation or new regulations to prevent future disasters like this from occurring? Because history shows us that the only way we as miners gain safety protection is by our blood. When the media leaves and the public forgets, where do we go from here? Will families who are most affected by these disasters be given a voice and a seat at the table? If God forbid this happens again, will miners rep again be involved in all aspects as we believe that Congress original intent was? Will transparency be restored? And finally, is MSHA going to hold public meetings on this as promised earlier, maybe to help identify the need for now and future decisions that need to be made for the protection of these mine health and safety workers?
Before you respond, some of the people on the phone are having trouble hearing, so if you could make sure that you talk into the mic.
I'm going to answer one of those questions, which is about our discussions with MSHA as an involvement in MSHA, with Alpha as an involvement of U.S. Attorney's local settlement. And it is not our settlement, it's the U.S. Attorney's settlement, and our discussions with Alpha were very limited since it wasn't our discussion, it wasn't our settlement. So you would really have to ask the U.S. Attorney to that question.
With regard to two or three issues, I'll try to answer at the same time. With regard to improvements in legislation, that's a question that you'll have to ask Alpha. I mean, I don't think there's been anything that we've received from them that indicated that they were supporting or don't consider to actually support legislation, but I don't know what they have said. We're on record. I personally, our office, Department of Labor, supporting reforms that we said then about a year ago, legislation for the court was necessary. We still say that today. Things that deal with workers' voice, advance notice and instructions, other provisions that are critical. With regard to how we proceed, how we share information, one of the things that we were asked to work cooperatively with the Department of Justice from the very outset, and it was a method of conducting investigations far different than I've ever been involved with in my career. I've been involved in a lot of investigations where there from the outset was the Department of Justice investigation, and MSHA was conducting theirs. And we agreed to do that, and we, as I said today, continue that pledge to work cooperatively with them, and particularly to bring to justice those that were responsible for this tragedy. During the process, we have tried to be as transparent as we could be, given the circumstances that we were all working with. And that's where we conducted, I think it was 11th family briefing today to keep the families up to date as much as we can, the congressional folks, and the general public, and try to balance that with conducting these simultaneous investigations. That wasn't an easy thing to do, but we felt that given the process that we had, that was our best approach. And I think that with what we have presented thus far, but the biography report, the independent West Virginia independent report has provided thus far is basically saying the findings. And we're releasing to the entire public today all of the documents that we have amassed that I think will be worthwhile for folks to read
to get a better understanding of the fines we've had and to answer some of the questions that's been raised.
Are there any considerable departures in this report from the McAteer report?
No, I can't say there's, I think there's some things that just a little tweaks that are different, but I think in generality it's pretty consistent with what Mr. McAteer has in his report as well.
Peter Galeska, St. Martin's Press. The McAteer report said that Massey had a habit and policy of aggressively challenging any amateur order, citation, what have you, and that in many ways rendered your enforcement efforts ineffective. Do you agree with that? Do you have any comment by that? Were you intimidated by Massey's legal efforts?
The short answer to that is no. If we were intimidated, we wouldn't have continued to issue orders. And what I see here at Massey isn't that much different than I see in the coal industry. A lot of people challenge us, and that's their right to do that. The bottom line is the inspectors who issued the paperwork out at the mine got the condition corrected and the hazard corrected. And the paper was put in place to take care of that. The fines and the violations are fought on another day. It's not fought the same day that the violation is issued. So I don't think that they intimidated us, and I don't think that they changed the way we did business.
If I could add to that, obviously one thing that happens when you challenge a citation is it goes through the litigation process. It could take years before it becomes a final order. Because at the time, MSHA was only relying upon final orders to put someone on a pattern of violations. I think that's what Mr. McIntyre was trying to refer to when he said that by challenging orders, they interfered with the enforcement.
This morning when they announced the agreement, they mentioned that Albert set aside $34.8 million to pay penalties. You've only assessed $10.8 million for penalties. Can you explain the difference maybe or why they might have a...
ALCO agreed this morning not just to pay the citations that MSHA issued today, but to basically resolve all outstanding contested citations before the review commission. So there's another $20 million, $20.2 million in those. There's about $1.25 million they've agreed to pay in citations that are outstanding but haven't been assessed. And then there's another amount, whatever the rest of that amount of money is, it's about $1.5 million. In citations which are final, which they haven't paid. So what they've agreed to do is to basically resolve all of the what we'll call Massey legacy citations.
How much is that total?
About $34 million.
Including today?
Including today.
Okay. Presentation. Are the DMSA making any recommendations for individuals that should be charged or charges that should be brought against the individual?
That's not MSHA's role. MSHA's role basically is to assist you by giving them the information that we have.
That again? Ms. Smith, you mentioned that the settlement agreement isn't MSHA's, not the Department of Labor's, the Department of Justice. Joe, I wanted to ask if their settlement requires a 2-year process for ALPA to install advanced accessibility meters to look at block dusting and continuous digital real-time readouts of ventilation and methane. Why is the U.S. Attorney doing this, and why hasn't MSHA already done it?
Well, Ken, I think first off, with regard to a lot of the issues that we have on the table, I think it's pretty clear to everybody that the U.S. Attorney's Office can move swifter than we can. Some of the things that's in that document were provisions in the proposed legislation last year, the use of the CDEM dust meter, developing that, the atmospheric monitoring. And I think when you look at the how fast things can move, this is pretty fast. And I think it's a way to get improvements in the mine fairly quickly, and I think that's one of the accomplishments of the agreement with the trade.
Well, also, this may sound technical, but it's quite true. I mean, from a legal perspective, MSHA can cite and issue fines, but MSHA doesn't have the ability to, quote unquote, forgive some of those fines and say, put them for better uses, so instead of paying us spending money on mine safety. But the U.S. Attorney, the non-prosecution agreement, has much more discretion to basically require them to pay money that they might otherwise pay in a criminal fine into to issues that they think will help resolve the underlying conduct. So the U.S. Attorney simply has much more ability than MSHA does to do that type of thing.
Those things have been done through rulemaking. I think that what you'll probably see is recommendations coming forward to address things like that. I think with the CDEM, NIOSH just concluded its research. We've been actually working with NIOSH on that about 3 or 4 months ago, Ken. It's a new device that came on board. But these are issues that I think that one would believe that we would be focusing attention on going forward.
Go ahead, Dennis.
I think I'm a little bit confused. MSHA's role may not be to prosecute, but you guys hold all the cards, you have all the information. You did the investigation, hear me out. So I think it's a fair question to ask if the agency is at least going to make recommendations as to how a prosecution should take place. Because the facts are, the investigation holds all the information that the prosecutors need to put to your case.
And all that information will be turned over to the prosecutor, and then the prosecutor will analyze that information using their expertise in the criminal laws that MSHA does not have expertise in to make a determination about what crimes they think have been committed.
And I'm not trying to be controversial, but if MSHA doesn't take a strong stand and say, these guys were criminals, and what they did, as our report said, was industrial homicide, then the prosecutors won't know how important it is to pursue what they need to pursue. That's why I think MSHA needs to take a strong stand.
Yeah. Basically, the way the system works is that the information many times is gathered by MSHA. It is then turned over to U.S. attorneys for further action because the ability to prosecute for criminal conduct is the Department of Justice. As I said earlier today, that our investigation is going into the next phase. All of the information that we have collected as part of our investigation will be provided to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think it's obvious that issues that we believe are conduct, which we normally would do in a normal way of delivering that information, will clearly be delivered to the Department of Justice in this case. And we see our role as working with the Department of Justice to carry out the points that we made. And part of that is bringing to justice those that may have engaged in criminal conduct at the Big Branch Mine, and all the evidence and information we have developed will be shared with the provided to the U.S. Attorney's Office. But that's the normal procedure that we will be using.
Dave Hooks.
There we go. I'm sorry. This is Steve Hooks again from Platts. So I wanted to be clear on this. The settlement announced this morning, the $209 million settlement, is separate from these additional fines that Alpha will pay.
No. Part of that $209 million includes the $34 million that I discussed with you.
Okay. And the second largest fine that Mr. Strickland was referring to, who is that?
Could you give me my face? Yeah. The legal was Magna Carta, so I want to be sure of that. Maybe the one sitting on the...
It was Magna Carta.
And what year was that?
I don't know the year, but it was Magna Carta for 59 contributory and non-contributory violations. We can look that up and get back to you, sir.
Is it on your website?
I don't know that.
Okay. How do you spell Magna? M-A-G-N-A?
M-A-G-M-A.
Magna. Okay, thank you.
Jim Sharp.
Sharp Media. I'm sure the family's asked you this question. I'd just like to know how you answered it. What did you say to them when they asked you why you didn't prevent this?
I don't think that question came up today, Jim.
Did it ever come up?
It's come up a number of times. And, you know, it's tough for me to say that I could prevent it when I had illegal notice going on, illegal advance notice when operators were pulling sprays off and they weren't following the minimum requirements of the plan. Is there a way that I think we could do better? And the answer to that always is yes. I think we can improve. I think we need to conduct more impact inspections. I think we need to look at the way we collect rock dust samples. And I think we're doing better. We issued 48 orders at this mine. It's not that my folks weren't doing anything. But I think we can always say we can do better.
That you issued 48 orders and they had to obey them and then they could resume. Shut down the freedom energy. Temporarily at least. No, I didn't shut it down.
We issued a 108A that required a plan. The operator shut down on their own. They could have continued the mine, but it would have been an expensive plan that they had to put in place.
Well, why didn't you do that in our good direction?
Let me just talk about freedom. Freedom was the provision of the Mine Act that had never been used until we used it about a year ago. And we constructed a case against the mine that had provisions that we felt that we needed to act. If you look at the length of time it took us to get from the time we made a determination to we got a resolution from the court, there's a number of months. And if you recall the testimony that I provided to the Hill, I've alerted folks that we needed faster tools than what that provided us. And I think the problem exists today is that there is not a magic law that exists that we can go in and shut down a mine based on a general thought of what we think we would like to have happen. There is legal procedures and processes in place. And we have separate kinds of tools that we're using, and I think much better now than we did before up at Big Branch. Or use the 104D better, 107A orders better than what we were. But, I think the freedom case was a case where we learned how we could use that tool, but also learned we needed to get a better tool.
That
wasn't just
that freedom. That's what we were asking for.
Ken?
Ken Ward again from Charleston, D.C. I'm not sure if anyone's mentioned the word bonanza here today, but I wanted to ask Joe, given what your team found at this mine, this mine seemed to you to be a mine that was being operated in a manner that one would have expected a mine to operate 100 years ago rather than 2010.
No, and I think it's the reason why I say no, but having said that, I can tell you this, the findings of our investigators found that the practices and conditions going on at this mine were what led to the disaster that occurred, that led to the deaths of 29 miners, that, you know, those conditions and practices that should not have been in place. If you go back to the turn of the century, we had, a lot more safety issues that were laying around the mines we also have today. Having said that, this is a coal mine dust explosion that should never have happened.
Rick Carter, West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Mr. Main, you said here that this report doesn't really cover MSHA's culpability in anything, but that we would be getting that report in 3 months or something, although you yourself on Metro News admitted the shortcomings of MSHA. And when we do get this report, would you say 3 months, will that be, we be assured of the objectivity of that report?
We're doing our best to take your fair report. Let me just spend a couple minutes on it. It's the 1989 Cairo mine disaster. There has been this process of the agency conducting internal reviews following every mine, major mine accident disaster. And I can guarantee when you go back and look at those reports, there's been a lot of problems that have been found.
That should be no surprise given the complexity of flying inspections. And I think when we issue our report, it's going to be one that's going to identify issues, it's going to identify shortcomings that we need to address, as has been in the past. We have said pretty straightforwardly that we've done a lot of things differently since April the 4th, and we've done for good reason. The impact inspections, being in some of these lines, when we went out for release inspections, the commandeering of mine funds, changing the way that we do general inspections, putting out notice on advance notice, something that once the information came out on the April 4th tragedy, something that we moved fairly forward with quickly, sending notice first to the mine operators in this country that that was an order of the practice, and sending inspectors out to report it for. And I think we've issued at least three different injunctions at mines where we've caught this kind of practice ongoing with our inspections. And so there's a number of improvements that we have made. We know we could do better, and as we go forward, we're going to be making even more changes.
But what would be the consequences of being in shop in this report in 3 months, and we'll be learning those as well?
Well, anything that we do as a result of that report, it'll be shared with the public, whatever the outcome is. And I don't want to appreciate
that. Then you will go on to make changes in your organization.
There is a change. There's changes already been made, and there's more that's forthcoming because we needed to do them, and we still need to do them. Oh, yes. There's been a number of them. We've actually done a number of by press release. I'll just wrap through a few of those. The impact inspection program, which is one that's aimed at really getting a better handle on problem lines and spending extra time at those mines. The total number of mines is somewhere probably around 350 mines that we have conducted impact inspections on since April the 5th, and a number of citations and orders to be issued. It ranges right around 6,800. The pattern of violations process, we've made some substantial changes to that. We revised the criteria that was used to look more at mines that have more trouble in the records. And we're actually having a process in place that sets a higher bar for mine operators to reach to clear themselves. And there's been 2 miles that have been placed on the pattern violations that didn't achieve that. We're taking a look at mines that are on a potential pattern violation whose record slips after they get off, and we put, I think, a couple of mines on as a result of that. We sent notices to the mine industry about ventilation requirements, about miners' rights to speak out, about rock dusting. We've issued the emergency temporary standard of rock jacking up, raising the amount of rock dust that's required in the mines, along with a number of other things that we've, that's just sort of a short list. And we've changed internal policies and procedures.
Peter Gillespie again. I have a question. You note here that the $10.8 million in penalties is the largest ever in MSHA history. Well, forgive me, but forgive my memory, but I believe that EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, another federal agency, and Massey, something on the order of $20 million in 1999 for an underwater flood situation in eastern Kentucky. And just a sort of philosophical question, can you explain the difference of $10 million and $20 million?
Yes.
Is water more important than
it's the law. It's the law. And basically, as Kevin pointed out, the flagments that we issued carried the highest penalties that we could. And if folks remember, we had supported changes in legislation that would increase the penalties under the Mine Act.
In fact, if I could add to that, last year when we were advocating for changes in the Mine Act, you basically pointed to the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and pointed out to Congress that the penalties under those acts were far more severe than the penalties that operators were subject to under either the Mine Act or the Occupational Health and Safety Act. I have said to Congress more than once in this country, it's more serious to kill a fish than to kill a person, the way that the acts are now. So we have been advocating to increase those penalties, both civil and criminal, and that's the administration's position. To date, those bills have not gone very far in Congress.
Ann Harlan, West Virginia News Service. this may already have been answered in one of the various reports that have been issued, but my understanding is that two of the miners, after an initial ignition, were seriously enough frightened that they tried to run away and that they were caught in the explosion. I found that a particularly chilling thought, and I was wondering what it says about how this explosion transpired.
I wouldn't use the word frightened. I don't know if coal miners have ever frightened. Basically, I think what we had is miners, that there was an ignition occurred, and for whatever reason, they couldn't control it, and it was getting out of control. They had no other tools to use to try to control it, and they tried to evacuate. During that process, after they traveled about 400 feet or about a two-minute window from that initial ignition is when a massive coal dust explosion occurred, unfortunately killing them in their spot right there where they had traveled to.
That's something that we would expect to see, that a methane ignition might take 2 minutes to spark a coal dust explosion?
No, you wouldn't expect to see that. Last year in the United States, we had approximately 40 ignitions. And I think there were only one or two that was not put out in a matter of seconds, either by the air, by the water, by rock dust, or by men putting fire extinguishers on them. So this is a very odd situation for this to occur and have a two-minute window in between an ignition and when the methane explosion actually occurred.
We'll now take calls from reporters on the phone.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you have a question, star one. First question from Ellen Smith, Mine Safety and Health News. Your line is open.
Thank you. I would like to know if you could read some of the language in the settlement agreement where it seems that it says that Alpha won't... there won't be any admission by Alpha or affiliate regarding civil liability under any local, state, or federal statute. What does that do in terms of pattern of violations for these nasty legacy mines?
It doesn't do anything. I don't have the agreement in front of me, but I believe it says except for the Mine Act, which means that once these violations are paid in full and the contests are withdrawn, that they will be final orders and they will be treated like any other final order under the Mine Act.
Okay. Now, there's one other...
Ellen, you're breaking up.
Okay, sorry. There's another question I have regarding some of the settlements that I see coming out of the solicitor's office and the effects that these settlements may have on inspectors. I mean, we certainly saw at UBB that mine inspectors were issuing lots and lots of citations. They issued a record amount of withdraw orders. What I see in other cases before the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission and settlements is that these 104D orders get reduced to 104A citations. There's a lot of compromise. We see 50% reductions in penalties, 75%, 90%. There seems to be an extreme disconnect. And there's always talk about change in MSHA and change with MSHA inspectors. But I'd like someone to address what conversations might be happening at the solicitor's office level regarding these settlements, the messages that are given to operators or MSHA inspectors when they see something that they thought was very dangerous, a dangerous condition, you know, go from a 104D down to a 104A and, you know, a proposed penalty going from, you know, $50,000 down to 20 or 10.
Well, not having any cases in front of me specific, it's hard to answer in specific. I can say, though, that in the what we call the backlog project, where we've changed our procedures, we are seeing a much higher settlement rate, so that instead of 40 and 50% reductions, we're seeing more like 20 and 30% reductions. But the solicitor office is does is it looks at the violation, it looks at the evidence. Often what's happening is that after the citation is issued, in the course of discovery, evidence comes out, and they basically make a determination on if they've litigated this case, what would be the likely outcome of litigation.
Any other questions on the phone?
Thank you. Our next question from David Curley, ABC News. Your line is open. David, your line is open. Please check your mute. And getting no response, we'll move on. Kimberly Kindy, Washington Post. Your line is open.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm having a really difficult time hearing most everything that people have been saying, so I wanted to run by some numbers that make sure that I heard it properly. Did you say that as a result of your findings with this final investigation, that as a result of that, those findings, you issued 360 citations to Alpha today, fines totaling more than $10.8 million, and that is roughly five times higher than any collective fines that you've ever issued in the past?
Yes, the 360 was non-contributory. In addition to that, there were 14 contributory issued for a total of 374 violations.
374 violations.
That's the total when I add the contributories and the non-contributories together.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And just to clear up the MAGMA penalty, I understand, and we'll double-check this one, was in August of 1993.
I'm sorry, say that again. Again, I'm having a hard time hearing.
MAGMA penalty that we talked about earlier, the second highest now, was in...
I'm sorry, this is the second highest ever?
No, the MAGMA.
The one that was the second highest ever. This is the highest ever.
Okay, thank you very much.
At this time, I'm showing no further questions from the phone lines.
Jim Sharp?
Okay, just a couple of questions, some of them technical in nature. The rock dust issue has to do, at least as you described, it has to do with the incombustible contact. But NIOSH found that there was also a weight issue, that is to say, that some of the dust was coarse, which means, if I understand it correctly, that it may have had enough incombustible content, but if it was too coarse, it still wouldn't suppress the fire. And my question to you is, number one, that's the standard. To check the weight of it, how much goes through the sieve, basically. But that's also something that you enforce. So I guess my question is you see the coarseness of this being an issue, and why wasn't this enforced?
The short question, Jim, as I think it's been pointed out in the investigation, there's a lack of rock dust, period. That was applied at the mine that created the problem. And with regard to the tailgate, there's a lack of evidence that rock dust was actually applied there. So you start with the equation. The quality isn't the starting point, it's the lack of the rock dust itself.
Well, then, in terms of that discovery from NIOSH, what steps are you now taking to deal with this aspect of the rock dust?
We've issued an instruction to the mining industry. Kevin, I don't know if you want.
Yeah, what we're expecting the mining industry to do is have certification that what they purchased from the different manufacturers does meet the requirements of the law, where 100% passes through a 20-mesh sieve and 70% passes through a 200-mesh sieve. So that's basically something that we're working through, and we'll expect operators to comply with that. But as Joe said, at UBD, it wasn't a question of getting it to see if it went through a sieve. It was a question of getting rock dust.
We have time for just a couple more questions.
Another issue is the CSET books issue was discovered or at least uncovered at Jim Wall in 2009. this year, there was testimony given at an MSHA hearing in Birmingham that suggested that that problem still exists in Alabama mines. That was testimony given before a panel headed by Pat Silvey, June 19th in Birmingham, I believe it was. Now, MSHA is aware of the possibility that there still could be two sets of folks being done maintained in Alabama. What have you done about that?
Let me say, the mine operators can have 20 sets of books. The problem is that they have to have their hazards recorded in the official record book. And if we find that going on, then we would take appropriate action and probably share that information with the U.S. Attorney in that area.
I think the testimony was pretty evident that the person who made this thought that the second set were off. Were books that should have been in the mandated book.
Well, that's something that we may be already looking into, Jim, but that's not something that, if we would find something and share it with the U.S. Attorney, we would not share that with the general public.
On the phone, David Crowley, I understand you would like to ask your question.
Yeah, either one of you, Kevin or Joe, you've kind of talked about the very specifics. Can you give me just the bigger, broader picture about Massey and its culture and what happened there first? And secondly, what have the families said to you about your report and this settlement?
I think our statement that there was a culture of valuing production over safety would be the overall theme that we've seen. As an example, on the intimidation of miners, in the 4 years leading up to the explosion, MSHA only received one hazard complaint from an anonymous miner at this mine. It just didn't happen here. So I think that's the prevalent theme that we saw was intimidation and valuing production over safety. I think the families were very appreciative of the work and the extensive work that we've done. I don't think that it satisfies them. I think they would like to know what the Department of Justice is going to complete in their investigation. And I think they're also interested in the MSHA internal review and what we find. So it's an ongoing process. It's a closure of the accident report, but it's not a closure of our total investigation into UBB.
And you are saying that this mine owner sent miners under there knowing that they were putting their lives at risk?
Well, I don't want to say they're putting their mines at risk. The miners are at risk, but I think they sent people underground knowing that they weren't complying with the regulation. I don't think that anybody wanted an explosion, would have done this if they knew an explosion was going to occur and kill 29 miners. But I do think they weren't complying with the regulations as they went about their day-to-day business at this mine.
About all the time we have for questions, unless
more.
Anyone wants to make any closing statements.
Let's take two more.
All right. Go ahead.
If I could just take one clear message.
Microphone.
Dennis O'Dell of my office. If I could just take one clear message back to our members after all this, because they're going to ask where we're going to go from the future and where eventually going to be in the future. If you have one clear message I could take back to our members as far as where the agency is going to be as far as protecting our health and safety, what would that be?
When I became Assistant Secretary, one of the things that I said straightforwardly to the mining industry, it is the mine operator's obligation to have programs in place to ensure that miners are protected, to find and fix conditions in their own mines, and to take care of the business that Congress intended them to do. And I've made it pretty clear, I think, from the time I came here, that as Assistant Secretary, that's my full expectation. I think miners in this country should expect us to do a better job as we go forward than even what we're doing today, and to hold the mining industry accountable for what the Mine Act said, to put in place programs and find and fix your conditions. And if they leave that important task to our agency, it's going to be a pretty stiff penalty for that. I think if you look at where we've moved the agency, the
discovered records. We're going to take action with those clients. How we beefed up the pattern of violations, we're serious about it. We need the industry to take that serious. We've also provided the tools for folks to understand that, so they do know what we intend to comply with the law. And as we move forward, we're going to be looking at making greater improvements. We have a number of regulations proposed right now to improve on safety. So I think, you know, what I think the nations, they should ask a lot of us. They should expect a lot of us. They should hold us accountable. We ourselves have to hold ourselves accountable to deliver the opportunity for miners to work every day, finish the shift, and go home free of illness and those injuries. And we intend to fulfill that promise as much as we can.
On the side, Jim. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
This is really a kind of a follow-up. Yes, Kevin, I think it's directed to you, but also to the Secretary. Kevin, you made a statement maybe a year ago or so that was rather shocking, I thought. You said that you know we will work to make sure there are no more UBBs. But you also, and I may have forgotten, I may not have the context of this right to clarify, but you also said that, and you do think that would ever happen again or something to that effect, until you started to see the results of the impact inspections. And what I took you to mean by that was the fact that MSHA has to go back time after time after time to some of these mines, and each time they go back, they find the same thing over and over again. So that left me with the feeling that out there might be 10 ticking time bombs. Was that a proper assessment? And if so, where do we go from here?
I'm going to have to take a little bit of time. I don't know if that's straight to me. I'm going to go back to April 4th of 2010. We're having a record year of non-fatalities. It seemed like we had everything under control. We, the mining industry, MSHA included. April the 5th brought me to my knees and should have brought everybody in the mining industry to their knees based on what occurred here. Shortly after that, Joe told me, you go out and you make sure we don't have anything else out there. We started doing impact inspections, and I was shocked at some of the things that we found after UBB. No curtain in the face area, two miners operating on the same split, dust so thick that you couldn't see the mining machine. And it made me realize that there's a lot of bad actors out there. Not a lot. There are some bad actors out there that just didn't get it. And we go back to these same places and find the same problems. And the only way that we found it was capturing the phones, going underground unannounced, and sneaking underground. Now, we have weeded some of those down, Jim. I think there's a five or six of them that have gone out of business or temporarily abandoned on their own, and it doesn't make me mad that they've done it. But if there's any more out there that's still doing it, they need to stop and comply with the regulations whether we're there or not.
That's about all the time we have. If you have additional questions after the fact, contact myself or Jesse, send us an email or give us a phone call. Thank you very much, everyone.
This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you for your participation.